I have called Senator Youssef's office 10 times in the last 2 weeks.
It's been 3 weeks. I've been calling every day.
Goes directly to voicemail.
I typically get no answer.
This has been a pattern.
Ohio voters say they're having trouble reaching their U.S. senators, and Kentucky's longest-serving senator announced his retirement last week. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our regional politics show, we'll discuss Senator Mitch McConnell's most consequential votes and how he's shaped the political landscape and the problems Ohio residents are having reaching their senators, Bernie Moreno and John Husted. We'll also talk about a property tax reform bill in Indiana and the priorities of the governor and state lawmakers there. We have lots of news to get into today. Joining me now are Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau, Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Welcome back, everybody.
Hey.
Great to be here.
Sylvia, I want to start with you. Senator Mitch McConnell made an emotional announcement last week.
Yes.
Representing our Commonwealth has been the honor of a lifetime. I will not seek this honor an eighth time. My current term in the Senate will be my last.
Sylvia, why is he deciding to retire now?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that he cited. Obviously, he's, like you said, he's been there for a long time. So he's been hinting for a while now that he is considering wrapping up his career. He's had a few serious health issues in recent years that have also kind of led people to believe that he might be stepping down. And he's been making a lot of legacy-related moves. You know, he's been talking a lot about what he hopes to do in his term to kind of push back against the direction of the party. He said that kind of pretty explicitly, especially when it comes to some of the more isolationist portions of the party, including some of the isolationist takes of President Donald Trump. And, you know, again, he's been there for a long time. He's mentioned, you know, one of his biggest kind of legacy I suppose achievements that he's mentioned quite a few times is his effect on the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court, and remaking the federal judiciary, really. So I think this has been a long time coming. There's been a lot of hints that this was on the horizon. And so we've been expecting this really for a while now. As I'm sure we'll talk about, a lot of people have already started jumping in the fray here to kind of vie for his seat.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to overstate the impact Senator McConnell's had on the Commonwealth and the country. Sylvia, what has been his biggest influence in Kentucky? I mean, is it just the growth and dominance of the Republican Party in the state since he got elected?
Oh, that's a huge one. I mean, you can't discount that. He, you know, won power. He rose to power in the Senate by beating a longtime incumbent in a heavily Democratic Kentucky at that point. And he is largely credited with orchestrating Republicans' kind of political takeover in Kentucky. Obviously, we now have a supermajority Republican supermajority here in the state legislature. And obviously, McConnell operates on the federal level, but he really has been integral in shaping that powerhouse. And of course, he's also credited with steering billions of dollars in federal funding back to Kentucky. So I think that you can't overstate enough how much his influence has played out here in both our political scene and also federal funding.
Of course, he was the longest serving Senate party leader in U.S. history. He either ushered through votes or blocked them when he was majority leader. Which of those moves stand out most to you, Sylvia?
I think probably one of the most significant ones is his choice to block Obama's choice for the Supreme Court in the final days of his presidency. And that kind of triggered this massive shift in the Supreme Court and also ushering through Trump's nominations for Supreme Court. So it's really reshaped our the head of the federal judiciary. And we've seen that play out in so many different ways in all of the Supreme Court decisions that have come down. That was a long time in the making. And it kind of, to some extent, started then. So that's one of the most ones that jumped to the mind first.
Karen, what are your thoughts? What impact do you think Senator Mitch McConnell's had on Ohio senators?
Well, I mean, certainly Ohio's senators, Bernie Marino and now John Husted, are strongly pro-Trump, and they've really pledged their support to Trump, the Trump agenda, to Trump's nominees, all of that as they came in. And what's really interesting here is that they really won't have a whole lot of time to serve with Senator McConnell, since they're both freshmen. This is their first. Marina was just elected in November, and Husted was just appointed to replace J.D. Vance, who became vice president. And so they really won't have a whole lot of time to spend with and serve with him.
What about in Indiana, Brendan? Brandon, do you feel like he had an impact on Indiana senators even over the years?
Well, I mean, you know, the political shift in Kentucky that Sylvia talked about has been echoed in Indiana in that time that Mitch McConnell has served in the U.S. Senate. Indiana went from a state that had Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate, notably, you know, Birch Bayh and then Evan, his son, Joe Donnelly, to it is a supermajority Republican state. It is governed at the top levels entirely by Republicans. I think Todd Young, one of Indiana's current U.S. senators and now its senior senator, I think you would probably say that he aligns closely with sort of the Mitch McConnell version of the Republican Party, not as isolationist, much more of that ilk that's which includes not necessarily always being shoulder to shoulder with Donald Trump on some issues, whereas the newest U.S. senator from Indiana, Jim Banks, who was just elected this year, is very much not of that sort. He is a MAGA Trump, you know, proudly MAGA Trump lawmaker through and through. And so it'll be interesting to see sort of Mitch McConnell's legacy. And, you know, Sylvia talked about trying to like steer the Republican Party in a certain direction as he exits. That battle might play out between Indiana's two U.S. senators a little bit.
Interesting. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for your call. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. You know, I think we all know what happened in 2016 with Merrick Garland and what Mitch McConnell did to prevent his nomination, stop his nomination. And we also know that it's very likely that if the same thing happened on the other side, he would be the first one to say that it's a horrible thing and it should never have been done. How do you think that will impact his legacy long term?
Interesting. Thank you, Chris. Sylvia, you want to share your thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the main things that people think of when they think of McConnell is that he is a politician. He really knows how to amass power, and he plays a long game. And that's how he gained so much power. I mean, he's from Kentucky. He's often talked about how most leadership on both sides, really, at least in the past, have been from the coast. They've been, as he would call it, or some would call it, coastal elites. And so he would say that, you know, his ability to sway politics is part of that long game, I think. And so that's definitely true. That's there are some times when Mitch McConnell would say that in that case, he was right to do it, that he was stopping a lame dunk president. And then maybe he would feel differently if it was happening to his own party. But that's also a little bit of just politics in general. And, you know, I think it's also really interesting. We've been talking about this a little bit, just what Brandon was talking about, is that McConnell has shifted away from his party in, you know, recent years. You know, his kind of clashes, his very public clashes with Donald Trump, you know, who has very publicly also maligned McConnell and his wife in, you know, on social media and at press conferences and things like that. So, I mean, I think that there's, you know, he's currently trying to build his legacy, but you definitely can't ignore, you know, he's had a long career and done a lot of things that are controversial, obviously, and that's how he's gained influence in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for that call and for that question. You know, you mentioned that relationship with Trump, Sylvia, and his relationship with President Trump really soured after the January 6th insurrection in 2021. He had such harsh words in the aftermath of that attack on the Capitol, but he ultimately voted against impeaching Donald Trump. Any thoughts on, you know, how you think history will view that vote?
That's such a good question. I think it all just kind of goes back to what I was just saying, that, you know, Mitch McConnell is a master strategist in a lot of ways, and he plays the long game. And at the end of the day, he usually does stick with the party. I mean, that's changed a little bit in recent days, recent months. You know, he's been voting against some of President Trump's nominations. But by and large, he has, you know, endorsed Donald Trump for the presidency. You know, he hasn't been really outspoken against him. He's taken a few policy differences. You know, in private, he seems to have said a few things, as you know, was noted in his biography that came out recently. You know, said a few things in private about Donald Trump, but you know, his outward facing persona has still been, especially when he was still the majority, or I suppose the minority leader, when he was still the leader of his party, he stuck with the line a lot of the times when it came down to it.
And you mentioned earlier, Sylvia, there are people who are already stepping up and saying they want to run for Senator McConnell's seats. Run through that list, his seat, run through that list with us briefly.
Oh, sure. So it's going to be a competitive race. It's already looking like. So top of the list right now is Daniel Cameron. He is a former McConnell protege, but he's distancing himself now from McConnell, I would say. He ran unsuccessfully against Governor Andy Beshear. A lot of listeners will probably remember that highly contentious race. And he did lose by about 5-point margin, but he's come back and he has announced that he's running. And kind of already starting to, like I said, distance himself a little from McConnell. We also have Congressman Andy Barr. He said he's considering running. He's a Kentucky congressman. And we also have, Nate Morris, who is a Lexington businessman here in Kentucky, a very wealthy businessman who has kind of taken a pretty hardline, ultra pro-Trump approach just in these early days. I think it's strongly implied that he is running. I don't know if he's made the official announcement, but he tweeted essentially to that effect. It should be noted that Governor Andy Beshear, whose term as governor would end right around the same time as the Senate race would be the Senate election would be taking place. He has said he does not intend to run for Senate. So that's pretty significant. A lot of people were kind of eyeing to see if he would, fall to some pressure to see if he would run for that, because he would have a real shot, a lot of people think, especially against Cameron, who he previously won against for the governorship.
Karen, we've been talking about the U.S. Senate. Some Ohio residents say they've had trouble reaching Ohio's new U.S. senators, Bernie Moreno and John Husted.
Hi, my name is Marcia. I live in Cleveland Heights. I have been calling Moreno's office just about every weekday since the inauguration. I've spoken to two aides, and recently, especially this past week, today, Saturday, was the first day I was able to get through to a person. Otherwise, a voicemail box has been full. John Husted's phone number has never worked. And this was also true when J.D. Vance was in office. I think they've had plenty of time to fix it. And if they can't fix their homes, oh my goodness. How are we trusting them to fix anything in our government?
This is William. It's been 3 weeks. I've been calling every day, each one of them sending emails. Typically, I will get no response, often, particularly on Senator Husted's line. It will not even take a message, which I understand there's a lot of activity going on. But what bothers me is that with the blatant destruction of the services for the American people, there has not been one single newsletter, call, or email sent out by our representatives taking a stand against this.
John, I have called Senator Husted's office 10 times in the last 2 weeks. My biggest concern is how the Trump administrations are acting. What I am really concerned about is Elon Musk. As a former government employee, I understand what it takes to get a clearance. I understand what it takes to be a government employee. Mr. Musk is now gutting agencies that have direct access to his companies. I wish that Senator Marino and Senator Ustedt would listen to us who have worked very hard for this country and not listen to Mr. Musk.
Karen, what's going on here?
Well, I know that Ustedt's office had less time than Marino's office to set up its whole setup. I mean, he was appointed in right before the inauguration, whereas Bernie Marino's office, he was elected, so he had a little bit more time. But this is a real concern. And one of the callers, as you just heard, saying that there were problems with even reaching Senator Vance. And the frustration from people that this is a government that is not listening to its own constituents who have real concerns about what's going on is really frustrating, upsetting, and even frightening to some people. And so I'm reaching out to try to figure out exactly what happened. There's been some reports about some phone lines not working, phone lines being overwhelmed, which you could see with a lot of people very frustrated with what's been happening and wanting to share their thoughts. But I don't have any answers yet. And what's interesting, in the last week, I moderated a forum where I had a discussion with Congresswoman Joyce Beatty from the Central Ohio area. She's a Democrat. And she was specifically asked, what is the best way to reach members of Congress to share your frustrations? And she said calling is a great way because you actually potentially can talk to a person. And that person, typically an aide, an intern, somebody on the lower level of the office rungs, would take the call, write down the message, take it to the member of Congress. And that's an effective way to communicate. But when you can't even get through, then you can't even make that happen. So it's a real question, and it's been going on for quite a while.
Brandon, have you heard any similar concerns about senators from Indiana?
I haven't heard it the way you're hearing it. It sounds like in Ohio. Obviously, I mentioned Jim Banks is the newest U.S. senator, so I don't know how much people have been trying to reach out to him. Todd Young, there have never been problems before. Generally, people consider Todd Young to be fairly reachable. His constituent outreach has been something he's focused on in his time in the U.S. Senate, which began after he was elected in 2016. He was in the House before that for three terms. So I don't think we've heard the same sort of intense problems with Indiana's U.S. senators, though, again, Banks is new, and so we'll see if that becomes an issue.
Yeah. What about in Kentucky, Sylvia? Have you heard any similar concerns with senators from Kentucky?
There have been a few concerns with people like showing up outside of offices, demanding to see, their lawmakers. We've had a few protests here. I think all the other states have seen that. But I don't know that I've heard specific complaints about a lack of phone calls. I think that there is a lot of frustration, just that there is no responses. There's no statements being put out. There's no outrage, which, maybe our federal delegation doesn't agree with that outrage. But there hasn't been a lot of communication, I think, is a common refrain I'm hearing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Karen, I know you're going to be near our neck of the woods later today to talk about Vivek Ramaswamy, who's expected to announce he's going to enter the campaign for governor. We're going to wait for your reporting on that. We're looking forward to it. But Brandon, I want to come back to you. Indiana Governor Mike Braun just got elected last year. He doesn't have to worry about running again anytime soon. What policy priorities did he really focus on in his first State of the State address?
The same things he talked about in throughout his campaign. So I have to say that in the campaign for governor, he had several, in some cases, very detailed policy proposals around things like he talked about some measures to sort of fight the effects of inflation, which were primarily things like further tax cuts or sales tax holidays for certain things, all of which he put in his budget proposal, because Indiana is currently in the midst of writing a new 2-year state budget. But he definitely focused a lot on trying to slash healthcare costs, which is a particular problem in Indiana. Indiana has some of the highest healthcare costs in the country. But the biggest thing by far is Braun's property tax reform proposal. So Indiana, like many other places in the country, has seen significant spikes in property taxes in recent years, as we've seen home values explode over the last, basically since the pandemic. And so not just Braun, but every gubernatorial candidate this last cycle last year, many state lawmakers, this was top of mind for them. In the legislature, it is Senate Bill 1, which is indicative of how high a priority the Senate Republican caucus puts on it. That being said, Mike Braun is now kind of fighting with the legislature over exactly what that property tax reform should look like, because Braun is proposing a much more significant reduction in property tax bills, which is good for Hoosier homeowners, but really bad if you care about the police or the fire department or emergency services or parks or libraries or city governments in general, because in Indiana, property taxes do not fund the state government at all. All of those dollars flow to the local level, and notably local schools. So that's been a point of contention between so far the Republican supermajorities in the legislature and Republican Governor Mike Braun.
We're going to talk more about the Republican governor's relationship with Republican lawmakers after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about regional politics for the full hour today and some of the biggest news from state houses in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, and Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Brandon, you were just talking about some of the friction between Indiana's governor and Republican state lawmakers and legislative leaders. What are some of the governor's budget priorities and his budget proposal, and how does that kind of mesh with what Republican lawmakers want to do?
Yeah, I want to give credit where credit's due here. Governor Braun, first of all, served in the Indiana legislature for a few years last decade, and so has relationships with lawmakers he served with. And on most things, Governor Braun and the Republican supermajorities in the legislature are absolutely on the same page. He's really trying to remake and slash government, state government, the administrative side of government, cutting agencies, one of his major budget proposals in order to pay for what's going to be a tight budget in Indiana. The revenue forecast we saw in December projects basically almost no new money for the budget in the second year of the two-year budget. So Governor Braun is slashing most state agencies' funding by 5%. He's reorganized his cabinet to make it a little more streamlined and kind of made people more accountable. You've felt it in the building. You have state agency leaderships really reaching out to lawmakers, being present in and around the building while the legislative session is going on. And so they've been on a lot of the same page. It's property taxes, which is admittedly maybe the biggest issue of the session besides the budget. But it's property taxes where they're diverging a little bit in sort of the end product so far. But yeah, I mean, his budget also had a lot of those sales tax holidays and tax cuts that I mentioned. Those did not appear in the House Republican budget proposal that advanced as the first half of the Indiana legislative session wrapped up last week. Because again, it really comes down to a dollars and cents thing. As Republicans do try to spend what little new money they'll have on education, on trying to fund Medicaid, they just don't find the room to also be cutting, I think, something like $700 million in state tax revenue that Governor Braun proposed.
Well, I understand, Brandon, that the budget calls for additional funds to expand Indiana's school voucher program. Explain that.
So this is part of Indiana first created its private school voucher program in 2011, and it's been expanding it ever since. This last little bit of making Indiana's private school voucher program universal actually won't cost nearly as much money as several of the other expansions have done. And that's because 2 years ago in the last state budget, or the one that we're currently under, they dramatically expanded the program's income limits up to something around $220,000 for a family income level. And so this last bit to make it truly universal lifts the income limits entirely. So anyone in Indiana who sends their kids to private school can get thousands of dollars from the state for doing so. And that's not exactly popular, certainly among the Democratic side of the building. But Republicans have been in lockstep on this issue pretty much since 2011 for the most part. So that seems to be going forward. I would guess that that will be part of the final budget come April.
Karen, universal vouchers, sounds familiar. And I know Governor Mike DeWine, his proposed budget would increase funding for private school vouchers too, but it's a pretty big increase, isn't it? Are you with us, Karen? We might have lost.
Sorry, I was muted there and couldn't get myself off mute. I was listening to Brandon there. I mean, vouchers, the last budget expanded vouchers to essentially universal vouchers. So pretty much any family who wants a voucher in Ohio can get one to send their kids to private schools. The larger your household income, the smaller the voucher is, though, at some point. But so what we've seen here in Ohio is an expansion of the voucher program. We have five voucher programs, but it's the EdChoice expansion program that's really gotten the biggest growth, because you have families who have sent their kids to private school all along who are now taking advantage of the opportunity to get a taxpayer paid voucher to continue to send their kids to private schools. So the bulk of the voucher expansion money and those vouchers are going to families whose children have never attended public schools at all. They've always attended private schools.
Well, and did the governor, I know he said in his budget proposal that he was going to be increasing funding for public schools, that he would fully fund the Fair School Funding Plan over the next 2 years for public schools. But does the budget really do that? I thought the Legislative Service Commission came out with some new information about that.
Well, what's interesting is that even though DeWine has claimed that the budget does fully fund the Fair School Funding Plan, what happens is the budget phases in that formula, but the financial inputs that are in that formula, such as salary data, that's from 2022. So the budget is not fully funding the Fair School Funding Plan, which the Fair School Funding Plan, just a quick refresher here, was the formula that was developed to try to take into account property tax value as well as income in districts and let the state share reflect that. So it could make it potentially constitutional. Ohio had several court rulings, four in fact, that said that Ohio's property tax-based way of funding public schools was not constitutional and the legislature had to fix it. That's what the Ohio Supreme Court said. So what we have here is a situation where public schools in Ohio, because of a variety of factors, are actually going to lose $103.4 million over 2 years compared to current funding. And more money is actually going to be going to vouchers and to charter schools, which are public schools, but they're not traditional K through 12 public schools. So almost $500 million more is going to vouchers and charter schools, while traditional K through 12 public schools are getting a cut of about $103.4 million.
Sylvia, I know Kentucky lawmakers aren't voting on a budget this late legislative session, but there's big money at stake with disaster relief in the state. Explain Kentucky's Disaster Relief SAFE program.
I would not say I'm an expert on the SAFE program in Kentucky, but, you know, we definitely have our own share of disaster issues here in the state. I mean, right now we're experiencing some pretty horrendous flooding in eastern Kentucky. We've just had one of our reporters, Justin Hicks, just returned from out in eastern Kentucky to cover that flooding. And we have some issues right now. I mean, Governor Andy Beshear was in Washington, D.C., you know, over the weekend, over the last week, you know, lobbying for more funding, trying to free up some FEMA relief for those affected areas. It doesn't look like the flooding is as widespread as the disasters that we saw in 2022, if people are familiar with those. But I mean, we're seeing some a lot of low-lying properties that had some really bad damage. And so really hoping to see some federal relief happening there soon.
Okay, fair enough. And I know the governor has also asked state lawmakers to lift safe program caps so that some state funds can head to those communities that need so much help. Is there much time during this legislative session in Kentucky to make new things like that happen? I mean, is there a way to kind of, battle the clock on that?
Yes. Yeah. So actually, we have a significant amount left in our session. They can move quickly if they choose to. The lawmakers can. Our session doesn't end until the end of March over here. So and obviously, if the governor's asking for a lift of that cap, then he wouldn't veto it. So they really have up until the very end of session to make that happen. And I think that there is some desire to do so among especially lawmakers from those regions. They are, heavily Republican regions largely that were affected by this flooding. So I do think there is some interest in doing that. And we'll just have to see if it ends up passing during the session. I think some lawmakers are saying that they need to look a little bit more closely at the books if that really needs to occur, if there really is an issue with existing caps. But we'll just have to see if they make that a priority here.
Yeah. We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back to wrap up our regional politics show. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our regional politics show. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Karen Kassler, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Brandon, I want to come back to this property tax relief legislation that's being proposed in Indiana. We talked about it just a little bit earlier in the program, but back up a little bit. Explain what the governor wanted to see happen and what Republican lawmakers are doing with that.
Sure. So the governor's plan was to reset basically every homeowner's property tax bills to 2021 levels. That would be a significant reduction in most people's, in pretty much every homeowner's bills. However, and I should also note that in addition to resetting those property tax bills, not affecting values, just resetting the bills, it would also limit the growth of those bills going forward to 2 or 3%, depending on the homeowner. The problem with that is that would cost local governments, so that's police, fire, schools, parks, libraries, everything at the local level, it would cost them billions of dollars a year for funding losses that they simply could not sustain. What Governor Braun has said is, well, then they need to increase taxes they have at the local level. So they have Indiana local income taxes. Not every county has levied one of those taxes. Not every county has levied them as high as they can go. There are also some wheel and excise taxes that help fund roads that could divert some funding away from the general budgets of local governments to try to offset those cuts. But still, functionally, what local government said is we cannot live with those sorts of losses and not dramatically cut critical services. And I think State House Republicans heard that. The bill has started, as I said, in the Senate. It's Senate Bill 1. House hasn't gotten its hands on it yet. That'll be in the second half of session, which begins next week. But Senate Republicans did not do almost anything that Braun proposed in his plan. What Senate Republicans are doing are targeting property tax reforms at certain populations. So that's age 65 and older, disabled veterans, and then a first-time home buyer tax credit. And so it's more targeted relief, and it also limits how much local governments control their budgets, or increase their budgets for the next few years, including the fact that in 2026 it would not allow local governments to increase the amount of property taxes they collect by a single dollar. That plan, I won't say sailed through the Senate, but it kind of sailed through the Senate, largely along party lines. And Governor Braun has taken a hard stance on that. He's threatening to veto the bill and call a special session if it doesn't, quote, improve. He's also, there've been a policy organization that Braun is affiliated with that kind of worked on all of his policies during the campaign. They've been targeting like digital ads at Senate lawmakers, Senate Republicans, saying, hey, they need to do better, do more like what Braun has been calling for, which is an interesting strategy to take from the governor.
Hmm. Brandon, you spoke about property taxes on your show, Indiana Week in Review. Here's what Democrat Ann Delaney had to say.
Even for first-time home builders, are they going to take that $2,500 to the closing? The problem is they need money for down payments. This does nothing for that. Nothing.
Brandon, what do Democrats want to see in this legislation?
I'll be honest with you. I don't think we've seen that many specific proposals on what they do for homeowners. I know that one thing they've really criticized the bills, both Braun's and the Senate Republican version, is that it completely leaves out renters in Indiana. There are some 700,000 or so people who rent in Indiana, and this arguably does absolutely nothing for them, and they've seen increased rents as people have seen increased property tax bills. Indiana does have a renter's deduction on their when you file your taxes. That hasn't been increased in years, and so that's one thing that Democrats have proposed. But I think Democrats understand the bind that everyone is in when trying to come up with property tax reform, which is there is unquestionably a need here. People's bills in some places have absolutely skyrocketed. But at the same time, to really dramatically impact that would really hurt local governments' bottom lines, because local governments have been dealing with some of the same inflation effects that average Hoosiers have. You know, we had mayors come down and talk about the fact that, you know, the cost to pave a mile of road in Indiana, at least in this one community, increased 40% in the last 4 years. So their budgets have been swelling, not because, oh, they're doing all these brand new things and these, shiny objects, as Governor Braun put it, but they've just been trying to meet the increased costs of so much of what they do. Hmm.
Karen, Brandon was just saying how that bill seemed to move pretty quickly in Indiana. One bill that's moved pretty quickly in Ohio is this higher education bill. What are the key provisions in that legislation?
Well, if you follow the Ohio legislature closely, you might remember Senate Bill 83 from last time around. That bill was targeted at public colleges and universities by Republicans and conservatives who feel that there's liberal indoctrination happening in those institutions. And so they developed this bill, and a lot of the language is similar to what we're hearing in other states and in a lot of Republican national talking points, with the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, with a ban on faculty strikes, with a requirement of so-called intellectual diversity in controversial topics. All of these ideas were part of Senate Bill 83. That bill changed a little bit, but never passed. It's back as Senate Bill 1. And in Ohio, if you're Senate Bill 1 or House Bill 1, it typically means you are a high priority bill that leadership wants to see passed. And so it's passed the Senate. The ban on faculty strikes was eliminated before. It's back now. This ban on nearly all DEI programs, that's in there as well. And it's now over in the House. And there are questions about whether union opposition will be strong enough to do anything about this bill. There were two Republicans who voted against it in the Senate, and one is definitely a pro-union, strong union supporter. But this looks like it's a bill that's on the track to move, and new Speaker Matt Huffman, who was the Senate president, has been a strong supporter. So it's likely going to move and move quickly, I think.
Sylvia, I know a Kentucky lawmaker has proposed an anti-DEI bill there, too. What are the provisions in that bill?
Sure. So if you were similar to Karen, if you were following Kentucky politics last year, this bill will be extremely familiar to you. It's very similar to a House bill from last year that then kind of took over a Senate bill and then ended up dying before the end of the session. So this is House Bill 4. It's by the same House Representative, Jennifer Decker. And essentially, it would also ban any resources or officers or offices dedicated to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. It also bans any trainings or any of these diversity statements that have occasionally been required for hiring in higher education. It also requires surveying of institutional free speech, which, you know, we've seen some of these surveys in other states as well, for example, in Florida, to determine whether or not students feel that they are being their free speech has been tamped down. And then we also have a lot of reporting requirements for universities, some pretty significant reporting to make sure, I suppose, that they are following along with these guidelines. And so, again, this is a very familiar. We saw this last year, and it is once again a priority bill. It was actually a priority bill last year, and it was very surprising to many reporters that it didn't end up passing the finish line in some form. And so I think there's a lot of hunger amongst many conservatives, many Republicans to address diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in public universities in Kentucky, and I think many are feeling also emboldened by some of the executive orders that we've seen out of President Donald Trump in his early days of his term.
So, Sylvia, do you think it's much more likely to pass this time around?
You know, I don't want to make too many,
predictions.
Predictions here, because I made them last year too, and I was wrong. So, but I do think it is more likely this year. You know, I've spoken with Republican leadership, and basically they had a kind of, they called it an informal work group that met during the interim last year to decide on what they wanted to pass and what they wanted to do. I think for many, they were disappointed that nothing passed the finish line last year, that it was kind of the strong disagreements between the two chambers that seem to hold up that bill. And so I think there is a determination not to let that get in the way of a bill this year. So we'll see if they succeeded on that front.
Brandon, how familiar does all this sound to you? Didn't Indiana pass legislation related to DEI last year?
Yeah, remarkably familiar. One, the higher education side of it that Karen talked a lot about, Indiana already did that, talking about diversity of thought, dealing with professors' tenure as well. They went through that debate already. Now they're going through a new one on the state government side of things, which is a bill that moved through the Senate the first half of the session, a bill that would ban diversity, equity, and inclusion in state government. So it was actually two different bills. They combined into one. And the first versions of them, the ones that came out of the committee, were incredibly broad. It had a whole list of terms and things that essentially not just state agencies, but anyone who got money from the state, any state contractors, weren't allowed to do or say or consider or train on or support. Like, there was a provision in that bill that said state agencies weren't allowed to take a position on anti-racism, which I think troubled some people, understandably. That combination of bills, now merged into one, got significantly scaled back. It does ban diversity, equity, and inclusion offices in state agencies and in higher education. It requires state and local governments and schools to publish online all training, instructional, and curricular materials that involve a long list of things that include diversity, equity, inclusion, race, ethnicity, sex, or bias. I think the authors of the bill so far have, especially now with this amended version, have trouble saying exactly what the bill actually does, like what problem they are trying to solve. They say they keep saying the same thing, which is it's about transparency and ending discrimination. But when asked, what discrimination are you talking about? They kind of vaguely source, well, we've heard some things in other places. We don't want it to happen here. Basically, what they're saying is, Black people were being hired or promoted, and white people should have been hired or promoted instead. And that's what it boils down to. But I'm not sure that this bill really does all that much anymore.
Well, Brandon, Sylvia was saying before that some state lawmakers in Kentucky feel kind of emboldened by what's been happening at the national level with President Trump and his executive orders and his talk about DEI and so many other issues. I want to ask each of you, if we have time, but I'll start with you, Brandon. Do you expect other legislative action in the State House in Indiana to mirror some of President Trump's priorities?
Yeah, and we already are seeing that on the immigration front. We've seen bills move now through the session that I think we will continue to see advance, certainly supported by the governor. Empowering local law enforcement agencies to act essentially as federal immigration officers and partner in whatever ways they can with the federal immigration officials on trying to round up and deport people who are here without documentation. So I think that's another prominent area in which the national sort of Republican mood is moving in that direction, and Indiana is happy to join alongside it.
Sylvia, are there other examples in Kentucky where you're seeing that national mood reflected?
Sure. I mean, we're definitely seeing it. I don't know if these not it's not really showing in priority legislation to an extreme extent. But, you know, we've seen, for example, legislation that would create a Kentucky version of DOGE. In fact, two bills on that front. We've seen another bill that would promote a quote unquote MAHA, Make America Healthy Again kind of initiative. And we've also seen some immigration related legislation to a similar extent that Brandon's mentioned here in Kentucky. So definitely seeing that. You know, I've also asked lawmakers, you know, what they're looking out for on the federal level. And I'm getting a lot of like a kind of a wait and see sort of mentality from leadership that they're saying that there are a lot of things that the federal government could do that would really affect what Kentucky needs to be doing. For example, I mean, if the Department of Education were actually basically eliminated, that would have a lot of effect on states. You know, it could have a myriad of effects, really. And so I definitely also see on the same front as I see proactive efforts to mirror the Trump agenda. At the same time, there's also kind of a watchfulness of how will these federal cuts, these federal changes trickle down to the states.
What about in Ohio, Karen? Are you seeing that Trump agenda reflected in the State House in Columbus?
I keep muting myself. Good grief. Concentrating on what my colleagues are saying here. I mean, we've got 125 bills that have been proposed so far in the House and Senate just since the beginning of January. And, you know, some of these are repeat performers, but I think there is a question about the governor's race and Vivek Ramaswamy entering the governor's race this afternoon in Butler County in Westchester. Mm-hmm. At a business there, and what he will bring in terms of that idea of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. So I think that there's a little bit of holding back on that rather than proposing bills that would create that kind of an office. But, you know, Ohio is very strongly, in terms of the legislature, pro-Trump. And so you can expect a lot of going along with the Trump-related policies from this legislature. It's just... I think a lot of carryover bills from last time around that were conservative ideas are going to come back, and we're going to see potentially more legislation this time because we don't have a speaker's battle this time.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Thank you all so much for your time today, for your great reporting, and for your insights.
Sorry for my mute troubles.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Welcome, Harper. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.